This is Tim Arson, the arsonist, El Perro Maniaco. You're listening to The Sound Off. This is Tim Arson, a.k.a. the arsonist, a.k.a. El Perro Maniaco, a.k.a. your daughter's crush. No, one more time, I'm sorry. This is Tim Arson, a.k.a. the arsonist, a.k.a. El Perro Maniaco, and you're listening to The Sound Off. With the solo monster, Brains.
Welcome to Spooky Sound Off 132 here on SEScoops.com. It is Halloween weekend 2010. I am the Solo Monster, and my favorite holiday is upon us here. I am so happy that Halloween is finally here, and I'll be sad when it's all over, but what can you do? It comes but once a year. I have an interesting Halloween story to tell up front here. I had an interesting evening on Thursday. I don't know how many of you actually get dressed up for Halloween. I know we have some younger listeners, we have many older listeners as well, and people with families, and probably people listening who have little kids too, and maybe you go out trick-or-treating with your kids. To me, I don't know that there's necessarily a cutoff, but no matter how old you are, it's always fun to get dressed up like an idiot on Halloween. It's probably the only day of the year that you can do that, because everybody else is dressed up like a moron too, so you don't stand out so much. So anyway, many of you know, because I had put pictures online at the time, that I dressed up as Hulk Hogan 2 years ago. Couldn't think of what I wanted to do, and I figured, you know, why not the Hulkster? If we're going to go the wrestling route, there's no wrestler that you can possibly dress up as that's more easily identifiable to even non-wrestling fans than Hulk Hogan. So I happen to have an old red and yellow Hulkamania, like classic Hulkamania WWF bandana from like 1988. I still have it in my possession. It was obviously one of the first wrestling shows I probably went to in person, and I must have bought it, and I've carried it all these years. So I had the bandana, I had to go out and buy yellow wristbands, I had to buy a sleeveless yellow Hulkamania shirt, the whole kit and caboodle, fake mustache, the whole nine yards. And it turned out to be a pretty fun costume. Especially when you're riding the train into Manhattan. I mean, there's a lot of very weird people on the train on Halloween. Well, there's weird people on the train even when it's not Halloween. But people were coming up to me wanting to take pictures with me, Facebook pictures, and they wanted my autograph. And I went through the whole... I cut a promo at someone's request, actually, on the train going into Manhattan. I had the whole character down. It was so much fun. But it was missing something. You know, I didn't have the Hogan wig. I didn't have the glasses. I didn't have the feather boa. I didn't have the muscles, unfortunately. I didn't have the steroid needles that I needed. In fact, I vividly remember walking into a bar. And, you know, when you get to a bar, you got to present your ID. They let you in. So I give my ID. And the bouncer, God bless him, the bouncer's looking at me, and he just starts cracking up laughing. Turns to his friend. He goes, "Hey, somebody put Hulk Hogan in the dryer. I wanted to strangle the man, but then I realized, you know what? This is a funny moment I'm going to look back on and laugh at. But I figured, you know, if I'm ever going to do Hulk Hogan again, I got to do it the right way. You got to get the muscle shirt, you got to get the boa, you got to get the glasses, you got to, you know, all that stuff. But I didn't want to do the same costume twice. So I figured, let's do something different. Last year I was supposed to be John Cena. Everyone knows that at the time, you know, I'm not the biggest John Cena fan, at least of his character. And, you know, I lost a bet, and I figured I'll go as John Cena. And I was really feeling it, too. I had to buy the You Can't See Me hat, and I had the shirt they made a couple of years ago. It was a baseball shirt with that classic WWF logo, only it didn't have the F. And when Cena was wearing all that old throwback merchandise, and I had the toy spinner belt, which made my stomach churn, but I had to get that as part of the costume. And I felt good about it until I went out and my friend saw me and said, "Hey, why are you dressed up as a John Cena fan?" And that just completely demoralized me for the rest of the night. So last year wasn't so much fun, certainly not as much fun as the Hulkster. So I figured, you know what, we're going to go a different route this year. We're not going to do wrestling. I don't want to be branded as the guy that does wrestling costumes every year. I'm not going to be that guy. So I found a costume that I thought was relatively funny. It's called the Double Occupancy Costume. You can probably Google it. You'll get the same standard stock photo. It's a new costume, I guess, that they created for 2010. It's an adult costume. Yeah, basically it looks like you're sleeping in a bed, only you're obviously vertical. You're not horizontal. And there's a hole that you stick your face in, and next to your head is a blonde wig, you know. So it looks like you're in bed. The bed sheets are covering you in this dummy. It was an amusing concept, until the costume itself came on Thursday. Now, mind you, when they told me that the costume was not going to arrive until October 28th, I thought, eh, it's cutting it a little too close, but I'm sure it'll be fine. So the costume arrives in this just ridiculously mangled box. It was actually two boxes. It was so goddamn big, they had to stick the costume in one box, which didn't have a top, and took another box and kind of condensed the two together, and it still didn't quite fit. So I get this monstrosity out of the box, and this thing is so huge. I mean, I would say from top to bottom, when it's actually fully unfolded, from the top of the bed, so to speak, to the bottom of your feet, the thing's got to be 6'3", 6'4", pretty damn close. And I'm not 6'3", or 6'4". So this costume requires help in order to get into it. Now, I wasn't sure if it was perhaps something that's strapped around you, and you can just kind of strap it on from the back. Oh, no! Oh, no! You had to basically put it over your head, pull it down, and this is almost impossible to do unless you have another person helping you. Now, much to my chagrin, once I put the costume on over my head, I realized there is a metal bar in the costume. Now, why is there a metal bar inside the costume, you might be wondering? Well, that's a good question. My only guess is that the thing is so big and so tall that in order for it to stay fully erect, that sounded dirty, you need a rod of some kind in the costume. So that was annoying. And I couldn't find the hole, story of my life. The whole thing was just an epic fail. And I realized at that moment, I've got to come up with plan B. I didn't want, and nobody wants to rehash the same costume after a year or two. I mean, yeah, it'd been 2 years, but I wanted to do something different, but I didn't really have much of a choice at this point, so I figured, well, it's always the Hulkster. So, I have some of the old merchandise, but I got to do it right this time. I need the boa, I need all that stuff. So, poor Solomonster had to run around town on Thursday night, and you can only imagine the lines in these Halloween stores. I mean, it's like Christmas. Imagine trying to shop for a gift on Christmas Eve. It's not fun. People are crazy. Lines, literally, snaking around the store. Naturally, I needed three items. One store had two of the three items. A different store had one of the items, which means I had to wait in two separate lines for about an hour and a half each. Not fun. Especially the one store where once I got to the front of the line, I was told that the credit card machine was broken and I would have to use cash, of which I barely had enough. That was amusing. But I got what I needed. So, lo and behold, the Solomonster will be going as Hulk Hogan. Yet again, if you happen to see the Hulkster parading around New York City, I'm sure I won't be the only one, but perhaps it's me. Come over and say hello. I'm ready to cut promos, take pictures, and sign autographs for a small nominal fee. And depending on how things go later, maybe I'll snap a photo or two and actually put them online. I actually did put the picture of the first costume online, like, years ago, after I did it. Perhaps I'll do the same thing later, just for your amusement. But, yeah, so anyway, figured I would let you know that little interesting tale there. Went a little crazy on Thursday night, but I got what I needed. Hopefully anybody listening who's going out this weekend for Halloween will go out, stay safe, and have fun. And feel free to tweet me or hit me up on Facebook and let everybody know what you're going as if you are, in fact, going out this weekend. So let's get to a couple of different news bits here. We'll kind of jump around, a couple of different stories, nothing terribly groundbreaking this week, and then we'll break into your feedback. The Undertaker Brock Lesnar situation. Let me just give a quick update on this. I'm sure you all know by now, but since it was a hot topic on the show last week, I figured I would address it this week. Any hopes of a Brock Lesnar-Undertaker battle at WrestleMania, which were slim at best anyway, were pretty much squashed earlier in the week by UFC President Dana White. He was interviewed. He explained that Brock Lesnar is not wrestling anywhere. He is under an exclusive UFC contract, which of course they would be crazy not to have him under. And he will not be doing anything at WrestleMania. So that pretty much ends any and all speculation. WWE was trying to put that match together. Nobody really knows for sure exactly how that whole confrontation came about at the pay-per-view. Undertaker is oftentimes, as Dana White in that same interview said, he is given comp tickets by UFC. This is not the first show that Undertaker was at. But there's no way they could have planned things to go down exactly the way that they did. I mean, Undertaker just so happened to be interviewed by an MMA reporter, Ariel Helwani. He was not in on any of this crap. At that exact moment that Brock Lesnar happened to be leaving the Octagon, this just seems impossible to me, like all of this was orchestrated right down to the detail in advance. From what I understand, at the post-show press conference at UFC 121, Undertaker and Michelle McCool were there. They were milling around in the hallway. And Brock Lesnar did not end up making an appearance at that post-fight press conference because he was still being stitched up. He claimed he didn't want to take away from Cain Velasquez's moment. Of course, Velasquez defeated Lesnar, and the spotlight was squarely on him that night. And once they made the announcement that Undertaker would not be at the press conference, from what I read, from what I understand, Undertaker and Michelle McCool disappeared. So my feeling on it most likely is perhaps something was going to happen after the show, before the press conference, or after the press conference, maybe in the hallway when Brock was walking. Maybe Undertaker would go up and jawjack and challenge him. And instead, it worked out far better because cameras were right there on the scene in the arena to film this entire thing. It's unbelievable to me how much buzz that one little comment created. But it just goes to show you, for all the times that WWE tries so hard to create a buzz for certain angles and storylines, not all the time, but more often than not, they can't do it. And yet, something so simple and so innocuous as this ringside interview that Ariel Helwani was conducting, one little comment by The Undertaker, I think that interview on YouTube at one point earlier in the week, which was shortly after this happened, had like well over a million views. I mean, it's probably, maybe it's closer to 1.5 million by now. I mean, it's just ridiculous how this whole thing blew up. I mean, there's no doubt Undertaker Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania would do a shit ton of business. To me, even if Brock Lesnar doesn't actually wrestle The Undertaker, you know, could you do something with him like they did with Mike Tyson at WrestleMania 14, where Brock is there? He would have to show up on TV at least once or twice beforehand to promote the event, which could be a problem because he doesn't like traveling. But maybe just have Brock at the event as a ringside enforcer. Maybe he knocks somebody out, or he gives somebody an F5, or something like that. You know, that might be more doable. But again, Dana White made it pretty clear that we would not be seeing Brock Lesnar doing anything with WWE. So let that be the end of all of that speculation, at least for the time being. Now, speaking of Undertaker, of course, Undertaker lost his third consecutive pay-per-view bout to Kane. That was in the Buried Alive match at Bragging Rights. Undertaker's going to be out for a couple of months. He's seemingly taking his annual injury sabbatical. He's got a really messed up shoulder. I don't know if it's the left one or the right one, but his shoulder is pretty fucked up. And the belief is that he may need surgery on his shoulder to repair a torn rotator cuff. And obviously, WWE would want him to get the surgery sooner rather than later because that, I mean, a surgery like that, probably you're looking at about a 4-month recovery. WWE does not want to be in a situation where Undertaker is not yet ready to come back and has to miss WrestleMania. And we're getting very, very close to WrestleMania. So if he has to have surgery, my guess is probably within the next week or two is when it would have to happen. Or they may just choose to have him rehab the injury without surgery. So I don't know that that's been decided yet. Undertaker has not yet had any surgery, but his shoulder is badly messed up. He has to let that heal or have it fixed. And at the earliest, I would not expect to see Undertaker on TV doing anything until January or February. Now, as far as what Undertaker does at WrestleMania since the Brock Lesnar match is nothing more than a pipe dream, I've heard two different things over the last week. One is that they're just going to build to an Undertaker-Kane rematch where Undertaker, I would presume most definitely, would get back his win over Kane and would advance to 19-0 at WrestleMania. To me, the idea of doing an Undertaker-Kane match at WrestleMania after three god-awful, shitty Undertaker-Kane matches on back-to-back-to-back pay-per-views in 2010 has absolutely no appeal to me whatsoever. I mean, I cannot tell you a match I would rather not see, more so than Undertaker-Kane at WrestleMania. Any other pay-per-view even would not be a good match, but I can accept it. But the fact is, we've seen Undertaker beat Kane twice at WrestleMania. Why do we need to see a third Undertaker-Kane match at WrestleMania? We don't. The other scenario, which seems more likely, which also doesn't excite me at all, to be honest with you, is that they're building to an Undertaker-Wade Barrett match at WrestleMania, which would make sense, given that Nexus interfered in that Buried Alive match and basically cost The Undertaker the match. You know, David Otunga kind of teased on Raw this past week that there was a reason why Nexus attacked Undertaker at the pay-per-view. He threatened Wade Barrett that he would reveal it to the world, which he did not. Not yet, anyway. So eventually, that would lead you to believe that we're going to find out exactly why Nexus attacked The Undertaker. We don't know that just yet. Undertaker Wade Barrett at WrestleMania does nothing for me. And it does nothing for Wade Barrett either, because the fact is, Wade Barrett is not beating The Undertaker. Nobody is beating The Undertaker. At this point, for Undertaker to be beaten at WrestleMania would be a mistake. I can see where people would say, well, Solid Monster, why would you not want to have a young guy beat Undertaker? It would put that guy over like $1 million. And you know what? Maybe it would. But to me, the streak has become bigger than just putting over a young guy. You know, Undertaker or Triple H or any of these other guys can put over a young guy on any other pay-per-view anytime they want. I don't like the idea of sacrificing. The streak has become a big deal. And to me, when Undertaker goes in the Hall of Fame eventually, that's one of the accomplishments that he should have on his resume. You know, here's a guy that went 20-0 or 19-0, undefeated at WrestleMania. You know, for him to go 19-1 or 18-1, it can't happen. It just, to me, it would be all wrong. And Wade Barrett, if you want to use him as an example, Wade Barrett's already being pushed a hell of a lot more than his level of experience would call for him to be. But, you know, Wade Barrett is improving in the ring. He's awesome on the microphone. I mean, I still maintain that Wade Barrett is among the top three talkers in the entire company. I mean, he has come a long way. Think about it. I mean, this is a guy that was on NXT wearing a cape when Chris Jericho started managing him. Now he's a bona fide main eventer. He doesn't need Undertaker to put him over at WrestleMania. Wade Barrett is already main eventing every single Raw show. He's in the main event segment every week. He's been in the main event of pay-per-views. He's going to be in the main event of Survivor Series. There's a pretty damn good chance he may win the World Championship at Survivor Series. This is not a guy that has to go over The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So I don't like that idea at all. Neither one of those matches appeals to me. Which begs the question, well, if not Kane and if not Wade Barrett, then who do you put him in the ring with? My idea has not changed. The best possible opponent at this point, short of some sort of freak attraction like a Brock Lesnar or a Bill Goldberg, the best possible opponent for Undertaker at WrestleMania is John Cena. And in fact, I'll even go one step further and say that a babyface John Cena, more so than a heel John Cena, is the best opponent for Undertaker at WrestleMania. Now, could John Cena potentially go heel between now and then? Sure. I mean, we've been talking about a John Cena heel turn for years, but I just feel like now we're in a position where it could really happen. It really could happen. But here's why I think a babyface Cena would be much better. The whole entire reason that I have said before, and I'm saying it again now, that Undertaker Cena would be a much better match is because John Cena, not so much the last couple of weeks, but for the most part over the last several years, John Cena has been booked as Superman. He is a man that cannot be beat, and when he is beat, he gets his win back, and he looks even stronger than he did before. And that's fine. John Cena is the Hulk Hogan of this generation. I get that. But it's almost to the point sometimes of being sickening. Never give up. Never say die. He beats guys with an attitude adjustment. If he doesn't, he makes them tap to the STF. He has made every single main event guy in that company, short of Rey Mysterio, tap out to that STF or be pinned by the attitude adjustment. He's beaten Triple H in the main event of WrestleMania that way. He's beaten Shawn Michaels. He's beaten The Big Show. Who else has he beaten? CM Punk, Edge, Chris Jericho, the list goes on. Now, to me, there is no better scene in my brain when I envision this potential match at WrestleMania than John Cena trapping Undertaker in the STF in the middle of the ring, 45,000 fans going absolutely apeshit in the Georgia Dome, thinking that this really could be it. John Cena has been booked as Superman for so long, and he's beaten so many different guys with this hold. Even the undefeated Undertaker may well tap out to that move. People would want to jump over the fucking guardrails. People would be going out of their skin. I would be going out of my skin because I wouldn't put it past them to actually have Cena win the match that way. Whereas if John Cena were to turn heel, let's say, between now and then and go into that match as a heel, I think the match would still have a lot of great heat. But does anybody really believe that if that's your main event at WrestleMania that they're going to put the bad guy over The Undertaker? Nobody buys that. But babyface John Cena, people could buy that. They may not like it, but they could buy that John Cena could well beat The Undertaker. And to me, that's the match that's going to drum up the most emotion. That's the match that even I can get into. And I'll tell you one other thing. I'm not the biggest John Cena fan in the world. I don't hate his guts like some people do. People take it a little too far. But I'm not a big John Cena fan. The fact is this, though. Randy Orton is the WWE champion. I have not been overly impressed with a lot of the matches that Randy Orton has been having. I did see the match with him and Wade Barrett at Bragging Rights. It was fine, it was okay, but it wasn't anything overly special. Whereas the John Cena-Wade Barrett match at Hell in a Cell was actually a pretty damn good match. The crowd was into it, it picked up at the end, it went like 20 minutes. It was good stuff. Randy Orton had matches with Sheamus for months. I'm not saying any of those matches were necessarily bad matches, but again, none of those matches set my world on fire. I remember John Cena having more exciting matches with Sheamus than Randy Orton did. You know, if you go back over the last couple of years, John Cena has had some pretty damn good matches with Triple H, Shawn Michaels, Umaga. He even got a pretty good match, if I remember. I think it was at one of the Judgment Day pay-per-views out of the Great Khali. Not even Triple H could do that. CM Punk, Edge. He actually, you know, when John Cena had that match with The Miz a couple of weeks ago, you know, that turned into a pretty good match, too. The point being, John Cena, nobody will ever mistake him for being a great wrestler, like a great technician or anything like that. But I got to tell you, the more I see Randy Orton wrestle, when I compare his body of work over the last couple of months as champion to some of the big-time matches that John Cena has had, not only this year, but in the last couple of years, I'm starting to waver a little bit as far as my opinion on whether or not John Cena is the better worker than Randy Orton. Randy Orton's not setting my world on fire, basically, is what I'm trying to say. And if you had John Cena in a main event match at WrestleMania with The Undertaker, with both guys turning it up 100%, I think you can also get a pretty damn good match out of it. Again, Undertaker is very limited now. I feel bad for the guy. He just looks... He truly does look like the undead. He looks like a guy that can barely move. He's a lot slower than he was even a year ago. He can't go the way that he used to. But I still think that's the best WrestleMania match for him. That's my opinion. Maybe you disagree. It doesn't look like that's the idea they're going to go with, and I think that's a big mistake. You know, and the other thing is that if Undertaker comes back in a couple of months and is thrust right back into the World Heavyweight title picture on SmackDown, he will officially be the modern-day Batista. I mean, Undertaker just lost 3 consecutive championship matches on pay-per-view. He has done nothing to prove that he is worthy of having a title shot. So whatever program they have set up for him upon his return in a couple of months, he better not get a title match because I may just explode. I would just... Again, these titles don't mean much. We all know that. But still, does he really deserve a 4th title shot? Yeah, the thing with Batista, he got so many title opportunities. So, I mean, every fucking month he got another title shot. By the time he won the belt, I was probably the least impressed person on the face of this earth. Because if you gave me a title shot every month, at some point I'm bound to win the championship, am I not? Same thing with The Undertaker. Let's keep him out of the title picture for a while. One of our listeners, actually, I think it was Sky Misha is his name. He had a great... I don't have it in front of me. I believe he sent something into the mailbag or he posted something on Facebook. A great idea that if you wanted to go in the direction of a Cena-Undertaker match where, you know, Cena right now is obviously a reluctant member of Nexus and perhaps Cena is revealed as the mastermind or the man behind Nexus putting Undertaker in the grave. If they wanted to really book this long term, they could come back to that. But to me, the only knock on that, I think that's a great idea. It would be great for consistency. The only problem is if you did that and it's revealed that Cena was behind it, Cena becomes a heel automatically. And again, I think babyface Cena is best for that role. So I guess we should probably, being that we're talking about Cena and Barrett and Orton, talk about Raw a little bit here. Another bad show. I was not a fan of Raw this week. I was not really a fan of any of these shows, except what I saw on SmackDown was actually pretty good. I still haven't watched the whole show yet. But Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler have just been tearing shit up this whole week. I mean, they had the best match on the Bragging Rights pay-per-view, which I did see. They had an even better match on Raw Monday night that the crowd, again, was really into. They had another match on SmackDown that was also very good that I saw. I mean, just fucking awesome stuff. Thumbs up to Dolph Ziggler and Daniel Bryan this week. And it makes me happy just because I know how good Daniel Bryan really is. And this isn't even close to showing you what he's really capable of. But given that he's wrestling the WWE style, he's still going out there and tearing the house down. People are getting into it. They're chanting his name. He goes out there and has, to me, of late, the most fun matches on any given WWE show, and I'm really happy that he's getting to show that to everybody. So that was definitely a highlight of Raw for me, but overall, not a fan of that show. And I'm not a fan, quite frankly, of the end of it, the big angle at the end, which I could see that coming from a mile away. You know, Cena was just about at his breaking point earlier in the show. He was ready to quit. Wade Barrett convinced him not to do that. There was a match booked on Raw between John Cena and fucking Randy Orton. Another John Cena-Randy Orton match. I could not believe... I could not believe it when this was announced. I don't know. I'm sure that was a big reason why I did not like this show. Forget. Look, we've had so many John Cena-Randy Orton matches. We just had one 3 weeks ago. We just had, what was it? Like, it was a tables match or something that we had. Why do we need to see these two guys have another match? Why? So anyway, the match, I think, had a fuck finish. I don't remember. But anyway, the big reveal at the end is that Wade Barrett and Randy Orton, they're having their rematch at Survivor Series. And Wade Barrett gets to pick the special referee for the match because he interfered. I think he attacked Cena. So Cena, of course, won the match by disqualification. So Wade Barrett picks John Cena to be the guest referee at Survivor Series, which is interesting because, again, it's the second consecutive pay-per-view now where John Cena does not have an announced match for the pay-per-view. He did ultimately wrestle at Bragging Rights unannounced. He won the tag team titles from Cody Rhodes and Drew McIntyre with David Otunga, although they promptly lost them the next night, further advancing the idea that these belts mean nothing. But Cena did not have an announced match for that pay-per-view. He was announced as being in the corner of Wade Barrett. And now for Survivor Series, which used to be one of the big pay-per-views of the year, Cena is a referee. So, I find that interesting. Not that I think it's going to make a difference anyway. I'm pretty sure Survivor Series is coming... Well, is Survivor Series coming the day after a UFC pay-per-view again? It might be. I'll have to check on that. Even if it's not, I don't expect Survivor Series to do that well. It should do better than some of the recent pay-per-views, but again, Survivor Series has not really felt special in years. It used to really have a special feel, and not so much anymore. But that's your Survivor Series main event, and the stipulation is this: if Wade Barrett wins the championship, John Cena is officially relieved of his duties from Nexus. However, if Wade Barrett does not leave as WWE champion, then John Cena is fired. And again, the provision is that if John Cena is fired, he cannot just go over to SmackDown. He is fired. Now, they could have Barrett lose, I suppose, or win but not win the title, and then just keep Cena off TV for a couple of weeks and then bring him back, but to me, that doesn't really serve any purpose. So, unless there's some other swerve involved here, it's pretty obvious that Wade Barrett probably is leaving with the belt. So, I don't know what that means. I suppose it would just mean that John Cena would then fight Wade Barrett for the title at TLC the next month. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. That's your Survivor Series main event. On the SmackDown brand, it's going to be Kane defending his World Heavyweight Championship against Edge. Edge won the number one contendership in a triple threat match on SmackDown this week, defeating Rey Mysterio and Alberto Del Rio, another fun match. So it's Kane and Edge. Again, another match I really don't care much for. I don't know if they're going to be doing any actual Survivor Series elimination matches. You know, we had a 7-on-7 elimination match at SummerSlam. We had a 7-on-7 elimination match at Bragging Rights. I don't know why you would need them again at Survivor Series. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they'll have one or two. Let's see here. One other quick Raw note, if I have the date here. We have a couple of three-hour Raws coming up. I think there's about three-hour Raws in the time span of about 5 weeks coming up, which is just completely ludicrous. The first one, I believe, is on November 15th. And it's going to be something called Raw Old School. I haven't exactly explained what that means. I would presume there'll be some old faces appearing on that show. I heard something about how they're going to be using the old school Monday Night Raw intro. I think the best thing to do would be to have a show like that from the Manhattan Center in New York City. I would say even do something like that once a year. You know, go back to your roots. Go back to where Raw started in that little arena, that little building in New York City once a year. Have an old school throwback type of show. I think that would be fine. To me, this show is incomplete. If they bring old people back from Raw's past, it's incomplete unless they don't have the Macho Man Randy Savage there. I mean, Randy Savage was an integral part of those early Raw episodes as an announcer. He wrestled too, but I know it's not going to happen. But to me, if you're going to do an old school Raw show, you got to have the Macho Man there. So that's on the 15th of November. November 29th is the next three-hour Raw show, and they're bringing back the King of the Ring tournament for that one. So this will be the first time we're having a King of the Ring tournament since, I believe, April of 2008. That was when William Regal beat CM Punk in the finals to, I think William Regal beat Hornswoggle in one of the earlier matches, and then he beat Punk in the finals, and it was such a goddamn garbage tournament. None of the matches went longer than like 4 minutes. It was so stupid. I mean, if you're going to do a King of the Ring tournament, do it the right way. I was a big proponent on episode 127 when I was talking about pay-per-views of bringing back King of the Ring as a pay-per-view. But if they want to do it on free TV, that's fine, too. They've got a lot of talent that they could stick in there. You can have, like, an eight-man bracket. They haven't announced who would be in it yet. I could see somebody like Alberto Del Rio, perhaps, escaping with a win there. You know, Miz, to me, Miz doesn't need to win King of the Ring. You know, Miz is beyond that. Miz is walking around with the Money in the Bank briefcase. He doesn't need to win the King of the Ring tournament. It doesn't accomplish anything. Somebody like a Del Rio or even Sheamus, who doesn't necessarily need it either, but John Morrison, you know, there's any number of names that I suppose can make sense. Just depends what you get out of it. I mean, if you're just going to become King of the Ring and you get to walk around with a crown, whoop-de-doo. You know, if you're going to get a title shot out of it, then it becomes meaningful. Maybe Daniel Bryan. I guess we'll see. And then there's another three-hour show a couple of weeks after that, early December. It's the 2010 Slammy Awards, which you may recall last year's Slammy Awards was hosted by Dennis Miller in what was just a complete just abortion. He did not do a good job hosting that show. But it was the kickoff to the Shawn Michaels Undertaker angle at WrestleMania 26. So hopefully by then they've got something planned for WrestleMania. Give WrestleMania some more long-term thought like they did last year. I mean, I know WrestleMania did not do very well on pay-per-view this year, but I still maintain the build-up to that Undertaker Shawn Michaels match was among the best build-up of all time. The video packages playing off their history of the previous year's WrestleMania, it was just awesome stuff. Hopefully they'll have something similar planned for this year. All right, our good buddy Corey was kind enough to watch NXT again this week and send in a report here, so I'm just going to go through this real quick. It was an NXT Halloween show on Tuesday night. So, of course, all the divas were dressed up in Halloween costumes. I guess Caitlyn was dressed up as Vicky Guerrero. She did the excuse me bit and then fell down as she was getting back in line with the other divas. I guess she was kind of imitating Vicky's fall from the obstacle course that they did earlier in the season. Michael Cole has the line of the night at this point when he says that was a better bump than she took in her match last week. That god-awful match with I guess it was Maxine. Let's see, Naomi was dressed up as the hamburger helper hand. AJ was dressed up as a Ninja Turtle. Audience picked Caitlyn as the winner. No shock there. More stuff with Oksana and Goldust. I guess it was said that if Oksana is not married by next week, she'll be deported, so I guess we're going to have a wedding next week. We had a Halloween candy-eating competition. I don't even have the time to read through all this here. Let's see. Oksana Goldust against Ted DiBiase and Maryse in the main event. Pretty standard match. Oksana rolled up Maryse for the win. DiBiase still did not get his $1 million belt back. Next week, we have the wedding between Oksana and Goldust, and it's also Elimination Week. So there you go. If you want to vote for your favorite diva, you can do so at WWE NXTForUs.com. So thanks, as always, to Corey for sitting through NXT for us. It is appreciated more than you will ever imagine. Another friend of the podcast, Sky in Seattle, sent in a synopsis on TNA Impact this week, so I'm just going to run through some of this real quick, too. I did see part of Impact on Thursday night, got home a little late. Thursday night was the night that I had my debacle with my Halloween costume. I had dinner sitting here ready for me at 7:30 or 8 o'clock or something, and when I realized my costume was pretty much a lost cause, I had to run out and buy a ton of shit. By the time I got back, I realized that it was perfect time for me to sit down and have some Chinese food and watch Impact, and I think the Chinese food was far better than Impact this week. I caught the show. I missed the first half hour or so. I picked it up with the Diva stuff. I tell you what, or the Knockouts, I'm sorry. I tell you what, the Knockouts match that I saw, which was Madison Rain, Sarita, and Tara against Mickey James and the Beautiful People, it wasn't a great match, but I actually thought it was pretty good. It was a hell of a lot better than anything you would see on the Diva season of NXT, which isn't saying much, but I thought this was fine. I really did. I thought this match was fine for what it was. I know apparently Impact opened with a big brawl between all of the Knockouts, which led to this match later on. But I wasn't offended by it. I thought it was fine. It was fine for what it was. Then we see Pope get beat up backstage by Abyss. Just going through the report here. That I did see. Apparently he put Pope in a coffin, and maybe I'm not up to speed on exactly what the significance of this coffin is, but it just seems so low rent. Why in wrestling would you have a coffin unless it had something to do with The Undertaker? I mean, when you're dealing with Kane or The Undertaker, or you're having a casket match, I mean, the whole concept of a casket match came from that character. I mean, it would be the equivalent of Ring of Honor having a casket match. It just seems so stupid and so low rent. It doesn't make any sense. So why? What is the significance of a casket in TNA? Do they have some sort of similar zombie, dead, undead character in TNA that I'm unaware of here? I know the people who run TNA are pretty brain dead. We all know that. They're all a bunch of zombies, but that doesn't explain why we have a casket on TV, so that's pretty stupid. Anyway, the main story of this show, and I do want to give TNA their props here. The main story of the show is that Mr. Anderson suffered a concussion last week. He was legitimately walloped in the back of the head with a chair by Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy apparently was not aiming to hit him in the head, but he hit him a little too high and legitimately cracked open Anderson's skull. He was bleeding. He suffered a pretty bad concussion. So this is where I give TNA their props. TNA has decided that Mr. Anderson is not ready to wrestle a pay-per-view match with Jeff Hardy, which is exactly what the plan was for Turning Point. They're keeping him out of the pay-per-view. He is out of the show because of the concussion. And the story of the show was Matt Morgan, who was a card-carrying member of Fortune, and I guess the Immortals, Hulk Hogan's Immortals by association, is, for whatever unexplained reason, showing sympathy and remorse towards Mr. Anderson. Now, everything that Morgan said has a lot of validity to it. You know, he was going on and on about concussions, they're serious business. I like the little touch where he threw in there at one point how, you know, he played sports or varsity sports or whatever, so he knows a thing or two about hard shots to the head and concussions. He had a whole bunch of them when he was, you know, growing up, which may well be true, by the way. But I appreciate that. That lent a sense of personal attachment, for lack of a better term, personal understanding to this whole thing, which could kind of explain why he had sympathy, but still it's a stretch. Because Matt Morgan has been a pretty unsympathetic heel character now for so long. Why all of a sudden does he give a shit what happens to Mr. Anderson? But whatever. I'm willing to look past that. So he talks to Ric Flair at one point and Eric Bischoff at another point. None of them are buying any of this BS. They don't care. So there's a match scheduled for the end of the show, a chain match between Mr. Anderson and Jeff Jarrett. Why a chain match? I don't know. Maybe I missed something last week. Was there some sort of explanation as to why we were going to get a chain match? Because otherwise, I don't really know why. But that was the main event. Matt Morgan came out in Anderson's place. Again, tried to convince Jeff Jarrett that this is wrong. And ultimately, what happened is Matt Morgan got his ass kicked. And Matt Morgan, I guess, has turned babyface again. And he will be taking Mr. Anderson's spot against Jeff Hardy at Turning Point. Not much of a pay-per-view main event, but I want to give TNA credit for this. I really do, because they could have very easily kept Anderson off the TV show, but put him in the pay-per-view anyway, They could have put him out there even on the show this past week, given him a reduced role, but still put him out there and put him at risk of injuring himself further because he is legitimately hurt. I give TNA a lot of credit for this. This is one of those rare occasions where TNA is actually doing the right thing and looking out for the health and well-being of its performers. I don't know how many of you, there was an article on, I didn't link to it. I liked it on Facebook. I read it a couple of weeks ago. It's from some website. Let me see here. It's worth going out of your way to read, so let me find out where it is. Here it is. It's a website called Cage Side Seats. You can go to cagesideseats.com. It's called An Examination of TNA's Appalling Treatment of Talent. It's a great article, very long, and it's not a positive story when it comes to TNA. But my point is, given that, this was one of those rare examples of TNA going out of its way to do the right thing and look out for the safety of one of its performers, and I applaud them for that. I can't rag on them too much. If this was a last-minute decision, they put Matt Morgan in there. I don't know that I would have picked Matt Morgan. You know, when you have other people like Samoa Joe and whatnot floating around, I think a Samoa Joe-Jeff Hardy main event would be far more appealing than a Matt Morgan-Jeff Hardy main event. But nonetheless, I want to give TNA their props. They did the right thing. So that was Impact this week. I talked about SmackDown a little bit before. I thought it was a good show. I liked it. More good stuff from Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler. A good main event. Thumbs up in my book. Couple of other news bits here. If you're signed up through SEScoops.com for the mailing list, you got an update directly from SEScoops during the week with news that the daughter of Vicky and Eddie Guerrero has signed a WWE contract. Shaw Guerrero, she's 20 years old, has signed a developmental deal and will be reporting to FCW very soon to begin training. So there you go. Now, she, I believe, was on the Eddie Guerrero Cheating, Death, Stealing Life DVD. She was at the Hall of Fame ceremony a couple of years ago when her father was inducted into the Hall of Fame. So she is apparently going to become a WWE diva, which is an interesting career choice. But, you know, I guess wrestling is in her family's blood. Her mom works for the company still. Her, I guess Chava would be her uncle too, would he not? So, anyway, good luck to her. That'll be interesting. I saw some pictures of her. Pretty girl. Let's talk about this election. I don't want to get into politics. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we're getting very, very close to this election on November 2nd. I cannot fucking wait for this election to be over. And I'm not just talking about Linda McMahon and Dick Blumenthal. Every single one of these races is so nasty and so vile. I mean, more than I can ever remember it. I am just completely inundated, as probably many of you are, at least if you live in the U.S., by all of these bullshit campaign commercials every single second of every single day. I cannot wait for this election to be over. I don't even care who wins. They're all bums. Every single one of them are fucking bums. I don't care who wins. I just want it to be over. Now, specifically, when it comes to the Linda McMahon race, it's obvious that it's a lost cause. She pumped about $41 million so far into this campaign. By the time it's all said and done, it may be closer to $45 million, which comes pretty close to the $50 million she claimed at the very beginning that she would be willing to spend. So congratulations on that. You wasted $50 million of your money. All the polls have her just falling and falling further behind. To me, there's literally no chance of her winning this election. So what happened this week is Vince McMahon went a little bonkers. We got more of this bullshit stand-up for WWE crap, more videos, more press releases. Vince felt that he was being persecuted by the state attorney general or whoever the hell it was, whatever her name is, Susan something or other, and claimed that his rights or the rights of WWE fans were being infringed upon because they weren't being allowed to wear WWE merchandise to the polling places and all that. Here's the deal. Vince may have had a point. Vince may well have been right. I don't care. This is nothing more than just showing off some bravado and trying to get some publicity, trying to get your name in the news. If I'm Linda McMahon, I'm hating my husband right now because this is not doing her any favors. In fact, her campaign has done everything they can to distance themselves from everything that Vince McMahon has been doing. So he has not been helping his wife at all. If anything, he's been hurting her chances. The big thing this week, some sort of court injunction was issued, and WWE claimed victory because they backed off and said, no, it's fine. People can wear WWE shirts to the polling places. Of course, the thing here is they were never really going to be banned from wearing WWE shirts. There was some sort of confusion. It was all bullshit from the beginning, but good for Vince. You know, it makes him look good that he quote-unquote won a court case. So, as if that isn't enough, apparently WWE is going to be giving out free merchandise to Connecticut voters. His quote here was, let's see, "I can't think of a better way for WWE fans to celebrate their constitutional rights and freedom of expression while voting than to proudly wear the WWE merchandise that Connecticut Secretary of State Susan Bisowitz attempted to prohibit from the polls." That's what Vince McMahon said. So they're going to be handing out t-shirts and hats and shit like that. They can't do it within 75 feet, I believe, of any polling place. So they'll have to be at least that far away. But they're going to be giving out merchandise. I don't know what that accomplishes. I don't see anybody wearing those t-shirts out in public at all. Even if they take, I mean, people love free shit. I mean, if I was in Connecticut, sure, I'd snatch up a couple of those shirts, but you're not going to catch me wearing three quarters of the crap that they put out. Now, having said that, this is a good segue into one other little story here. It's not really a story, but I saw some people online. Somebody scanned in a page from the December issue of WWE Magazine, or from whatever their latest merchandise catalog is. And some of you out there who like to buy WWE shirts and stuff, you might find this interesting. I thought this was pretty cool. Apparently, they're going to be selling WWE old school merchandise. Perhaps they'll announce this on TV when they do the old school Raw next month. Maybe there's some sort of tie-in there. None of the merchandise is currently available, but it's up online. If you go to WWEshop.com, you're not going to see anything on the main page. Go into the search box and type in old school and hit enter. And you're going to get, it's two pages of WWE old school merchandise that sometime within the next month or two, I guess, is going to be going on sale. It's a collection of classic t-shirts, some hats, I think there's some hoodies. That's really all that's up right now. But, for example, you can buy yourself a vintage Royal Rumble logo shirt. It's actually the Royal Rumble logo that they started using in 1996, but nonetheless. A vintage King of the Ring shirt with the old school King of the Ring logo, which I think looks really cool. I don't quite know the significance of this, but they're selling a blue SummerSlam 94 shirt, which actually to me, I don't know why, but to me that looks the coolest. A vintage Survivor Series logo shirt. They have a classic Monday Night Raw red t-shirt with the old Raw logo, and they have a Raw is War logo shirt as well. The old school WrestleMania logo, and again, the WWF logo is the old school logo, so you're allowed to have the F. It has the F in it. Again, they're not allowed to use the F with the scratch letter Attitude Era logo, but for whatever reason, all the logos before that are fine. So they have a whole bunch of stuff like that up there. They don't have any wrestler logo shirts right now, like Hulk Rules or Bret Hart or anything like that, but if you're into that sort of shit, go to the website, type in old school, check it out. You can sign up for an email alert when the merchandise becomes available. And, yeah, so I thought that was pretty cool and far better than most of the shirts they sell nowadays. Although I will say TNA has this new Jeff Jarrett Bones shirt. It looks kind of interesting. I'm a sucker for shirts with skulls and skeletons and stuff like that. And the only real wrestling insignia on it, I know one of the skeletons is holding up a guitar, but the average person is not going to make the connection to Jeff Jarrett. The only thing on there really is a little TNA logo on the very bottom of the back of the shirt. Otherwise, it looks cool. If anybody orders that shirt, let me know how it looks. I don't want to spend I cannot bring myself to spend $28 with shipping on a fucking t-shirt. But let me know how that shirt is. It looks kind of cool. Anyway, went off on a little bit of a tangent there. Back to the political bullshit for a second. The reason I bring all this up is not even so much to give you an update on the campaign, because Linda McMahon is going to lose. But the Blumenthal campaign this past week, or the week before, brought in Michael Benoit, the father of Chris Benoit, to vent, essentially, on why Linda McMahon cannot and should not be voted in, and all the bad things that Linda McMahon and WWE are responsible for, and they're the devil, and they're Hitler, and this and that. Here's the deal with Michael Benoit, okay? I sympathize with the man. Him and his family, I'm sure, have been to hell and back. I do not envy the heartache and the heartbreak that he and his family were put through in 2007 when his son did what he did. Okay? It's a horrible, horrible thing. And in many respects, WWE certainly can bear some responsibility. There are things that they could have done. The way they handled the Benoit thing was abominable. When it was revealed that Benoit only had testosterone in his system, and a ridiculously high level of testosterone at that, and WWE basically claimed victory and said, see, we told you he didn't have steroids in his system. To me, I still shake my head and can't believe that, because if they believe that testosterone is not a steroid, well, then I'm the fucking prince of Egypt. In other words, it's bullshit. So the way they handled that whole thing was atrocious. I mean, WWE is far, 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 far from innocent. Having said all of that, when I hear Michael Benoit flying in on behalf of the Blumenthal campaign, and I don't know if they paid for his flight and any of that stuff. It doesn't matter to me. He comes off as bitter, whether he realizes it or not. And the fact is this. As much as I can blame WWE for a lot of stuff, like I just said, you cannot blame WWE for the fact that Chris Benoit murdered his wife and murdered his son. They are not responsible for that. And with this political campaign, and God knows that Linda McMahon and her husband have, believe me, they know the political game as good as anybody, okay? They have no problem lying about shit, pulling the wool over people's eyes. They're very shrewd people. When I hear Michael Benoit speak, essentially trying to get Dick Blumenthal elected because Linda McMahon is the devil, I mean, he never actually said that, but that's basically what he's alluding to here, it makes me a little sick inside. And as much as I hate to say this, I really do, the only response I had when I read the transcript and I listened to Michael Benoit speak, my only logical impulse and response is to say to Michael Benoit, please shut up and go back to Canada. What you have to say has absolutely no relevance to me whatsoever as a voter. If I was a voter in Connecticut, I would not give a shit what Michael Benoit has to say. It has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on that campaign. If I'm a Connecticut voter, I'm going to vote for Linda McMahon, or I'm going to vote for Dick Blumenthal, and it will have absolutely nothing to do with anything that comes out of Michael Benoit's mouth. Even if he has the best of intentions, and not everything he's saying is as kooky and crazy as you might think, it comes off so badly. He looks like such a desperate character. I don't care what you have to say. It has absolutely no bearing on this campaign, so just shut the fuck up and go home. So anyway, that was my first reaction. Maybe it's not the best reaction to have. I'm sure he's not a bad guy. Again, he's been through a lot. I don't care what Michael Benoit has to say anymore. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. So I wish he would just go away. Sorry about that. Had to get that out of the way. One last quick piece of news here. William Regal has signed a 42-month contract renewal. I'm not sure what the significance of that is. I know he just turned 42, but yeah, he signed a pretty long contract extension, so apparently they have plans for him, maybe as an agent or a trainer or something like that. I mean, he's not going to stop wrestling. He's still an active member of the roster, but clearly they've got plans for him to be part of that company for a while, which is great. Regal is a great performer. You know, who knows what could have been in his future had he not flunked that last wellness test back when he was the GM and he was one of the biggest stars on Raw. And I don't know that they were grooming him for an eventual title run necessarily, although you never know. I mean, if Jack Swagger could be a champion or Wade Barrett potentially can be a world champion, why not William Regal? But he never really recovered from that. You know, they brought him back. He's pretty much been a mid-card player ever since. But he's a great performer, very entertaining, and I'm sure he has a wealth of knowledge that he can pass on to younger wrestlers. So pretty happy to hear about that. Let's break into the Halloween mailbag here this Halloween weekend. Jason writes into the podcast, Dear Solomonster, just listened to last week's show, heard about Michael Cole saying Randy Orton versus John Cena is best rivalry of our generation. We know this is a lie, but I want to ask you, what is your favorite rivalry or build-up for a rivalry? I think you mentioned it before, but I forgot. I think I mentioned it before, too, and I honestly don't remember what it was, because I have a couple of different ones. Not in any particular order. I mean, as far as great build-ups to matches. Steve Austin and The Rock at WrestleMania 17 had a damn good build-up. I think the Mega Powers angle back in 88, 89, leading up to Hogan vs. Savage at WrestleMania 5 was phenomenal stuff. And supposedly, as urban legend has it, was actually an idea that was pitched by Elizabeth, of all people. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I find that to be interesting. Macho Man Randy Savage and Jake the Snake Roberts, to me, is one of my all-time favorite feuds. It's one of the more underrated feuds in WWF history, and it didn't go nearly long enough to be anything legendary, necessarily. But for the couple of months that it went on, it was phenomenal stuff. And for 1991 WWF, it was incredibly intense. There was no, you know, yeah, the snake and everything, but other than that, there was nothing that I would say was cartoony about it. You know what I mean? It was a serious, dark, intense feud, believable, with two extremely talented guys. Jake the Snake, nobody better in terms of ring psychology and promos than him back then, and maybe even ever. And Savage has always been a very intense performer. He's always been a very intense person, period. So that was really, really, really good stuff. I just said earlier, the build-up to the Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match at WrestleMania this year, I thought was top-notch stuff, maybe among the best of all time. Some of the matches they've had, have been some of the best of all time, but the build-up in particular to the rematch and the video packages and everything just was so, so well done. It was awesome. I mean, WrestleMania to me was a one-match show because of those two guys, and the build-up was done so well, I could not have been more excited for a match than I was to see Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker get in the ring at WrestleMania. Just great stuff. You know, the build-up to the Montreal match with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels was great. Another great video package. Even in WCW, I mean, the build-up to the initial battle in 97 on pay-per-view between Sting and Hollywood Hulk Hogan was very, very well done. And if not a bit on the long side, but very well done. Unfortunately, that was one example of following up some great long build-up with an absolutely horrible match. But the build-up itself, it's impossible to build up a match for as long as they were able to build that match up for. In 2010, it would be impossible. But the build-up for that match was very, very good. So those are just a couple of examples of some of the build-ups that stick out to me over the years. See, Vic from Vegas writes, and I actually used Vic's question in the SE Scoops mailbag on the main page on Thursday, which was the October 28th mailbag. So if you missed it, go on the main page, find it, check it out, leave your comments underneath the post. I'll just reread this question here since he actually sent this in to me. Dear Solomonster, what do you think of CM Punk being groomed as the next color commentator for Raw? I think it would be a brilliant move. His mic skills are great, and I think Jerry Lawler's shtick is getting old. Well, again, Punk is awesome. I mean, Punk is awesome at almost everything he does. His commentary, you know, on Raw Monday night, the time that he was on NXT, just hilarious. Great stuff. And not even just hilarious, but, you know, the way he was putting over Daniel Bryan on Raw during that match with Dolph Ziggler. And it looks like they're building to a potential Punk-Daniel Bryan feud for the U.S. title, which would be absolutely fantastic, although Punk is nursing a really bad hip injury. They're not quite sure what is causing him pain in his hip. He went for an MRI. I would hope it's not a serious injury, but if it's not, it looks like that's the direction they're going in. But Punk is great, and I think Punk, after he's ready to hang up the boots, would make for a fine color commentator. But I wouldn't want him to become a commentator at the expense of putting his in-ring career on hold, because he's much more valuable as an in-ring performer, especially as, you know, we lose guys like Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho and potentially even Triple H and The Undertaker. We're going to need people like CM Punk to step up. As far as Jerry Lawler is concerned, Lawler used to be the best, or just below Bobby Heenan anyway. And in that SC Scoops mailbag this week, I linked to a YouTube video. So I would go find that post, click on the link. It's to a Jerry Lawler promo from Raw. You know, he used to announce, but he would also wrestle sometimes. And it was he was backstage, and Vince from the announce booth was kind of interviewing him, asking him about some match that was coming up with Goldust, who he was feuding with at the time. This promo, let me tell you, I can't believe this promo aired in 1997, let alone I cannot even fathom this promo making the airwaves in 2010. Even for then, this was way, way, way over the top. But just go back and watch the promo, and it'll give you a sense of how edgy, funny Lawler could really be back then, with his one-liners and his zingers and all of that stuff. I can't really blame Jerry Lawler. It's not like he's a different person. He's older. He's a babyface as opposed to a heel. But I think if WWE let him, if it was a different time, if it was the non-PG era, he could definitely be at least a little more edgy with his commentary. It'll be nothing like it used to be, but it's just the nature of the product. Vince McMahon would never allow Lawler to make comments like that. So Lawler is nowhere near as fun as he used to be. He's kind of a waste in a way. He just seems so fake and phony, but I won't lay that at the feet of Jerry Lawler. I lay that at the feet of Vince McMahon. Dear Solomonster, been listening for a while now. It's the only wrestling thing I watch or listen to anymore. What do you think about The Undertaker losing this tired and very old dead man gimmick? I'm tired of it. Would much rather see him confront Brock last Saturday, for example, the way that he did, rather, in that character. If Taker does take time off for another one of his annual surgeries, I think him returning as himself, or I guess that would be the American Badass biker, would be a better draw than his current gimmick. And why not a heel turn? Wouldn't bother me at all. Taker actually looked cool confronting Brock Lesnar. What we've been seeing is the very old Undertaker. It's the worst look he's ever had. If Taker takes time away, what would be the best thing to do when he returns? And what do you think they will actually do? I think what they'll actually do is bring him back as the dead man. And let me say this. I will not deny that Undertaker looked cool confronting Brock Lesnar. Stupid as it may have been in hindsight, because they're not going to get anything out of it, he looked like a badass. You know, he was a little older, but he looked like a badass. And here's the thing, though. Undertaker needs to retire when he's ready to retire as the dead man. That's the gimmick he needs to go out as. And if he's going to stick around for a little while longer, I don't have a problem reverting back to the biker gimmick, but I still think when it's time for him to have that one last match, he needs to be the dead man. And he needs to be, quite frankly, with Paul Bearer. They've reunited and broken up so many times. It shouldn't be a problem in a year or two, if that's going to be it for The Undertaker, to let him go out as the dead man with Paul Bearer and the urn raised high. That's the way he should go out. But if he's not going to go anywhere yet, then you know what? Maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea. Maybe it would be one way to really freshen up the character. But you talk about a heel turn. I would not be in favor of that at all. Undertaker, in my opinion, has reached the point now that Ric Flair reached. I know Flair is a heel on Impact, but the fact is people don't want to boo Ric Flair. People still woo when he does the chop, and they still cheer for him. It's like Shawn Michaels. If Shawn Michaels was still around, could Shawn Michaels really at this stage of the game pull off a legitimate heel turn? He could barely do it in 2005 with Hulk Hogan, and that was only because it was Hulk Hogan. You know, when he kicked Hulk Hogan in the face, he got most of the fans to start booing him. But even so, it was never really officially a full-fledged heel turn, because people never really stopped cheering Shawn Michaels. You know, you reach that certain legendary status where, I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's very difficult to turn the crowd against you. And I would not be in favor of an Undertaker heel turn. I'm completely fine if you want to tweak his character, make him a little more human, a little more badass. People are going to cheer him no matter what. Don't turn him heel. But the dead man gimmick, in my opinion, that's the gimmick he needs when he's ready to call it quits. Ludeboy sent in a one-line email that said, Dolph versus Daniel Bryan on Raw equals the best match since WrestleMania. Well, check out their SmackDown match. I think you might even like that match a little bit better. They have been kicking ass all week. Got a letter from James, a new listener here. It's your Solomonster. First off, my buddy told me I should check out your podcast a few months ago. I enjoy the work you do and feel you make some solid points. Have two questions for you. Number one, we all know that these newer heels do not compare to some of the greats, but with guys like The Miz, Zack Ryder, and Robbie from TNA, the Shore guy, Question is, do you think these guys can get over as heels, or will this be the new wave of how heels look in the world of pro wrestling? I know not all heels can be the same, but these guys come off more like douchebags that I know I wish would go away against guys like Million Dollar Man, or rather Ted Jr., Wade Barrett, AJ Styles, and so on. Not saying that they can compare to Jake the Snake or Roddy Piper, but they are better than the above two names. If you're not a fan of the Shore guy from TNA, you're not alone. I mean, it's a rip-off gimmick. He's only been around a couple of weeks. Yeah, he comes off as more of a douchebag. Zack Ryder is more of a comedic character now along the lines of a Santino. If you're asking me basically I'm not even sure what you're asking necessarily. You mentioned Wade Barrett, AJ Styles, and Ted DiBiase Jr. I'll do you one better. I don't think there's any heels in wrestling right now that can compare to some of the best heels of 20 years ago. If you take Jake the Snake Roberts in late 1991, which I talked about earlier, and he might be a bad example because Jake is at the top of the list. But if you take him as an example, or even if you take the Million Dollar Man character, and you want to compare that to a lot of the heel characters today, name one that can really compare. And it's not even necessarily their fault. I mean, I think when people are trained and they're brought into the business now, as opposed to 25 years ago, it's a different mentality. They're being trained differently. In WWE, for example, new guys who come up, unless they do some sort of acting training on their own, on the side, they're coming up at a time when every word is scripted out for them. They don't know how to cut promos on their own. They don't know, you know, psychologically, little mannerisms to make during their interviews or little ways to move their bodies during a match or how to interact with a crowd. It's just not the way they teach things from all accounts down in FCW, just using that as an example. So name me one heel who today could compare to some of the greats from 20 years ago. It's kind of sad, actually, when you think about it. But, again, it's not entirely the wrestler's fault. It's just it's the people who train the wrestlers, who know better, who I think should be blamed for that. But that's the best response I can give you on that question. Now, the second question here, something that is bugging James here. He says, with all the studies and what we know now about extensive drug use, and while we always knew multiple concussions, but newer studies showing how serious it is, do you think it's fair that people still tear Chris Benoit apart the way that they do? I'm not trying to defend his last days alive, but it seems that perhaps there's more than we will ever know. After all, no one was there when it all went down. Sorry. People go to mental hospitals and stuff like that all the time. Not saying they're all killers, but it's clear they are not 100% in touch with what is going on. So what I want to know is, what are your feelings on the whole issue now that some time has passed, and how do you feel every time his name comes up? I ask because of the deal with his dad and all the BS, but reading what people wrote on SE Scoops in the comments section, just trashing the guy like all the commenters themselves were all innocent and pure, just bugs the fuck out of me. So, asking someone who seems to be a bit more open to different points of view, wanted your input on the issue. Chris Benoit, when I hear the name Chris Benoit and I think of his image in my head, it just makes me very depressed. Depressed because of what he did to his family, but depressed as a wrestling fan because I just can't bring myself to look at his matches and his storylines and his world title run from 2004 the way that I did all those years ago. It's impossible. I cannot separate one from the other. Because the Chris Benoit thing, you have to understand something here. It's the biggest tragedy in the history of the wrestling industry. It got more mainstream press attention than any incident. And there's been a lot of bad shit that's happened in wrestling. I mean, Bruiser Brody getting murdered the way he did in Puerto Rico back in the late 80s, for example. A lot of bad shit has happened in the wrestling business over the last 20 or 30 years. But there was no bigger story than the double murder-suicide involving Chris Benoit. And certainly not with a wrestler on that level. Here's a guy that was respected by everybody in the wrestling business, who was in the wrestling business for 20 years, 20 plus years, who won the Royal Rumble, who was in the main event of WrestleMania in Madison Square Garden, 20th anniversary, winning the world championship. You cannot think of a bigger star who was involved in something like this ever. It's a big deal. You cannot separate one from the other. I mean, some people can claim that they can, and if they can, good for them, but I can't. I can never look at the guy the same way. I can look at him for what he was. He was one of the greatest in-ring wrestlers of all time. But to me, it's great that Chris Benoit could fake wrestle better than anybody. But in reality, he killed two people, including a 7-year-old kid. There's never, ever been any evidence that's come out to suggest that his wife actually killed the kid and that he killed his wife in retaliation. Could it have happened? Sure. All the evidence would point to otherwise. And you're right. None of us were there. We'll never know. But there are still certain facts that exist. And warning signs in advance of very bizarre behavior. And again, you know, Benoit could be a violent guy. You know, there was documented physical abuse in his past with him and woman. Not like he was such a nice guy. Oh my God, I can't believe he would ever lift a finger. No, well, he kind of did lift a finger before. He had a mean streak in him. It's not out of the realm of possibility to think that he would be capable of something like this. Anybody can be capable of something like that, even if they go crazy. Now, you know, the point you make about people commenting about, I guess, Benoit's dad and all this, or Benoit himself, like, those people are all pure and innocent themselves. There's no such thing as a pure, innocent person. Especially if you're posting on a wrestling website, let's be honest here. We've all done things or said things that we're not proud of, or, you know, we're not all little angels with fucking halos over our heads. But again, you gotta distinguish here. People posting on a wrestling message board, no matter how stupid the comments may sometimes be that they make, most likely did not murder two people. At the end of the day, that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a guy that did something so fucking horrific that I can never bring myself to have respect for somebody like that again. And if I were in charge of WWE, if I go back to the podcast I did a couple of weeks ago when I outlined my whole plan, this is what I would do if I was in charge of WWE, and I think one of the things I talked about was the Hall of Fame. If I were in charge and I had a say in who goes into the Hall of Fame and who doesn't, Chris Benoit does not ever get into my Hall of Fame. How could I ever put somebody like that in a Hall of Fame? Been a lot of bad people that have gotten into the WWE Hall of Fame who are not angels, but to knowingly put somebody in the Hall of Fame, for example, who murdered their wife and son just because he was such a great fucking wrestler, yeah, no, that I have a problem with that. And I know some people would disagree. Some people are going to write into me and say, you're wrong, you got to separate the wrestler from the person. And he was a great wrestler, and it's a wrestling Hall of Fame, and therefore he was a world champion. He deserves to be in the wrestling Hall of Fame and not the people Hall of Fame or the humanitarian Hall of Fame. I can't do it. I can't separate the two. Now, if Chris Benoit was already in the WWE Hall of Fame, and we found out later on that he killed his wife and kid, would I take him out of the Hall of Fame? That's an interesting question. That's an even better question. I think at that point, I probably would leave him in. The problem I have with it is we know what he did. We know the fate that he met and the fate that he chose for himself. To then knowingly give him the honor and the distinction of being in a Hall of Fame because he was such a great wrestler, I have a problem with that. So that's my honest answer on the issue. Yeah, and one other quick point. Strictly from the point of a publicly traded company, if I am the president and the chairman or the CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment with these lavish Hall of Fame ceremonies as part of WrestleMania weekend every year, how the hell can you ever put Chris Benoit in the Hall of Fame? Do you know the shitstorm that company would come under if they even quietly slipped him into the Hall of Fame? I mean, so strictly from the perspective of a person who would be in charge of a company like that and responsible for making that call, if you're waiting for the day that Chris Benoit is going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, you're going to be waiting an awfully long time. I cannot ever envision a scenario where that happens. And I fully support that. Adam from Southport, UK writes in with his scariest moment in wrestling, which I asked you to write in with a couple of weeks ago in the spirit of Halloween. Adam says, let's see here, been listening to the podcast since episode 125, but I'm going to download the rest of them. Good for you. My scariest moment in wrestling history is from the 2000 Royal Rumble. It was during the swimsuit contest, and we had to be subjected to Mae Young's horrible-looking breasts. When I was watching that live, I was only 12, and I believe it has left a deep scar. You and everybody else. Pretty sure it was a prosthetic piece that she was wearing. It was, or at least, That's what WWE claimed, because I think they were potentially going to get into a lot of trouble. And they claimed that, I think Vince, the story goes that Vince McMahon had only recently seen the movie There's Something About Mary with Cameron Diaz for the very first time. And I still haven't seen that movie, but I guess there's a scene in that movie with something similar, I guess. So that's where he got the idea from, and it was actually a prosthesis that she was wearing. I don't care what it was. That was fucking gross. So, Adam, thumbs up on that. That truly is one of the scariest moments in wrestling history. Marcus has an interesting question. Dear Solomonster, would you happen to know what was supposed to happen with Eddie Guerrero in 2005 before he sadly passed away? P.S. I loved episode 31. Keep up the great work. I assume he meant 131, but perhaps he's a huge fan of Sound Off 31. So, if that's the case, thank you. It was pretty apparent where they were going with the Eddie Guerrero thing. If you remember, before he died, him and Batista were like bosom buddies, and they kept teasing a potential heel turn that never actually happened because Eddie died. I believe Eddie was supposed to go heel and turn on Batista, which would lead to a match. But from what I understand, the WrestleMania plan for Eddie Guerrero, and again, this was months before WrestleMania, at a time even then when WWE was constantly changing its mind, so it's possible this plans would have changed, but there was a lot of discussion for WrestleMania 22, which would have been the following WrestleMania. That was when Eddie did get inducted into the Hall of Fame. Before he died, the talk was that they would potentially aim for a match between Eddie Guerrero and Shawn Michaels. If you remember, what WWE ended up doing was kind of haphazardly putting the storyline together where Vince McMahon came out on Raw at the end of December, at the end of 05. This would have been right after the Bret Hart DVD. The first Bret the Hitman Hart DVD was released. And I think Vince came out and they were kind of promoting the DVD or he was saying, talking crap about Bret Hart. Shawn Michaels came out. And Shawn Michaels came out as this bastion of goodwill to ask Vince, you know, please, let's just move past this. It's been so many years. And Vince took umbrage to this. And somehow that started this big feud between Vince McMahon and Shawn Michaels, which led to a match between them at WrestleMania, which Shawn Michaels made that match work. I think Edge and Mick Foley had the better match at WrestleMania 22. And even Triple H and John Cena, for just the crowd reaction alone, had a pretty good match in the main event. But Shawn and Vince was a fun match. It was a garbage match. Literally, they were just using garbage and weapons and stuff, but I thought Shawn Michaels brought Vince McMahon to one of the better matches he's ever had. Maybe not as good as the Vince and Shane match at WrestleMania 17, but it was still pretty damn good. However, it kind of came together in a haphazard way, and it was not at the level of what we expect from a Shawn Michaels WrestleMania match. So it makes sense to me that they would have tried for a Shawn-Eddie match, and that match would have just blown everything else on that card out of the water. I mean, at that point, Eddie was so jacked up on steroids, or had been. His body was so much bigger, and he was older. I don't know that Eddie would have been able to have as good a match as he would have had, you know, 5 or 10 years earlier, when he was a little smaller and more like his normal size. But an Eddie Guerrero-Shawn Michaels match at WrestleMania, could you imagine how fantastic that match would have been? That's kind of sad to think about. We came very close to having that match, and unfortunately, it just never happened. Longhorns Dude writes in, Dear Solomonster, my scariest wrestling moment was when Judas Macias ripped through the ring with blood pouring out of his mouth and choked out Abyss in TNA with a barbed wire rope. That was one freaky-looking dude. Dusty Rhodes, from what I understand, is one of the commentators for Florida Championship Wrestling. My question is, number one, does that mean he is under contract with WWE? And number two, if so, SmackDown is having problems with its announced team. Why not use Dusty? I remember him being pretty entertaining during his WCW announced days. First of all, Dusty Rhodes is under contract to WWE. He has been for many years. He was an agent once upon a time, and then somewhere along the way, not long after they started up that developmental territory, he went down there to help out. So that's what he's been doing. And he does. I think it's him and Josh Matthews have done a lot of announcing together down there. I know Byron Saxton is also doing announcing, but yes, he is under WWE contract. Now, for the second question, look, it can't be any worse. You know, the announcing situation is looking pretty bleak in WWE when they have to use Michael Cole on every single show. They're really, really thin on talent. I don't think you could find anybody that would ever say Dusty Rhodes was a great wrestling announcer during his WCW days. I enjoyed his shtick for what it was. It completely goes against what Vince McMahon wants, though. I mean, part of the reason Vince got rid of JR and wanted to get rid of him for years was not just because JR had the Bell's palsy and, you know, he wasn't the most attractive guy to look at, but he was a Southern wrestling guy with that Southern accent, and Vince doesn't like that. I mean, JBL was a SmackDown announcer, and he was fine, but JBL was always one of Vince McMahon's favorites. the fact is, Dusty Rhodes, it doesn't get more Southern in terms of that Southern drawl than Dusty Rhodes. It totally does not fit with what Vince McMahon would want on one of his TV shows. And you know, besides that, Dusty Rhodes doesn't want to travel. That's part of the reason Dusty... I think, actually, Dusty went to WWE. He might have gone to Vince or Stephanie a couple of years ago and asked specifically to be relocated to Florida so he can just stay there and work at FCW because he just didn't want to be on the road anymore. I mean, Dusty is getting older. He's in his 60s. He doesn't want to travel. So, for SmackDown, if he was going to be a SmackDown announcer, the travel wouldn't be that extensive, but he would still have to travel for the SmackDown tapings, and he would still have to travel for the pay-per-views. And I don't think Dusty Rhodes wants to do that. So all of those reasons are they kind of combine to give you a sense of why he is not currently on SmackDown. My good friend Ronnie the Rib writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, just a quick question. How could you leave Abdullah the Butcher off of your top 12 scariest wrestlers list on SEScoops.com?" Well, I was bound to miss a few people. I do admit I completely forgot about him. if I had Abdullah on my brain at the time, perhaps he would have made the list. But you know what? Maybe not. Yeah, the thing about Abdullah is I didn't grow up on him. He did a lot of wrestling in Puerto Rico. He was in WCW, but I'm actually not as familiar as most people might be with Abdullah the Butcher. I mean, I am now because I've seen more of his matches through YouTube and stuff like that, and I know of him a lot more than I did when I was younger. But I didn't grow up on the guy. He never really scared me. I mean, the whole thing with the fork is obviously very scary, but I didn't have Abdullah on my brain at the time. And yeah, he not that he doesn't deserve to be on that list, but again, it was meant to be a top 12. You know, if I wanted to do a top 20, he would have made the list, just like guys like Vader, for example. Vader, when he used to come out with that thing on his head in WCW, was a scary fucking dude. And Vader would go in there and beat the shit out of people. I mean, really beat the shit out of them. To the point where, if I were a wrestler, and I were told that, hey, you're going on with Vader tonight, I would quit, and I would find something else to do, because there's no way I would ever want to step in the ring with Vader at his peak. You know, there's just no way, so... You know, Vader and Abdullah, those were a couple of guys that could have made that list too, but not everybody's going to make the list, so there you go. Want to wish the Rib a happy first anniversary. Him and his wife are celebrating their anniversary on Halloween this weekend, so congratulations to the two of you. And lastly here, Lee from Manchester, England writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, do you think MVP is doing his own version of a Matt Hardy by trying to get himself released?" I think it's pretty obvious that's what he's trying to do. He's been making comments on Twitter that apparently have pissed off a lot of people in WWE. I would say that it puts him in the doghouse, and that's why he's doing a lot of jobs. But let's be honest, MVP, he's been doing jobs for a long time now. And it kind of goes back to that incident with the drug tester. You know, when WWE guys are drug tested, they have to pull their pants down around their ankles, lift their shirt up above their nipples, and piss in a cup in front of a tester. You know, it's not something that's pleasant, especially if you have stage fright. But, you know, the story is that this was a couple years ago, and MVP made a comment to the effect of, you know, is this what you... I don't remember exactly. It was something to the effect of, is this what you went to school for, or is this what your mother would be happy seeing you doing? He made some stupid comment, and it pissed off a lot of people. I think the tester complained, and he's pretty much been in the doghouse ever since, so... I'd say it's pretty apparent that MVP is trying to send some sort of message. He's not stupid. He knows that making those comments in a public forum like that is probably going to get him a lot of heat. Doesn't seem like he cares. Why should he? You know, he's probably not happy in WWE. He's not getting any sort of push. He's jobbing left and right. He gets barely any TV time. You know, if I'm him, I have a cushy job. I'd be happy with that because MVP is not on the same level as even a Matt Hardy. Matt Hardy is going to TNA. Matt Hardy is a talented guy. He has a lot of friends in TNA. His brother is in TNA. If Jeff Hardy wanted Matt in TNA, he'd snap his fingers and Dixie Carter would bring him in. MVP, you know, he's friends with Matt Hardy. He's friends with a lot of guys, too. But I don't know that if I'm TNA, I look at MVP and say, wow, here's a guy I have to have on my roster. Especially if Matt Hardy's coming in. And you don't want to reinforce this perception that all you do is sign all the fired WWE guys. Yeah, I'm not so sure that if MVP gets the boot from WWE that he's going to be showing up in TNA anytime soon. So if he wants to make some decent moolah, I'd be pretty happy if I were him. I don't know that I would want to be making waves right now. So that's it for the mailbag this week. I'm going to tie this bad boy back up. It needs more questions from you. It's already digested the questions from last week. It's hungry. It needs some new food. So email me at solomonster@gmail.com. Don't forget that the SE Scoops mailbag on the main page goes up once a week. For that, you can send questions to sescoops@gmail.com or just send them to me. And if I'm running low on questions in a given week, your question might make the front page. So friend me on Twitter or follow me on Twitter, rather. Twitter.com/solomonster and, of course, facebook.com/thesolomonster. Important to know because one of these weeks, maybe even this week, but we'll see, I'm going to be doing another Twitter or Facebook mailbag. I haven't decided yet where for the next week's show, whatever week that is, I would take questions exclusively from Twitter or from Facebook. And you're not going to know about it if you're not signed up with me on there. So again, follow me, friend me, all that bullshit. And when I'm good and ready to have a mailbag, you'll be the first to see it, submit questions, and we would do that on the next show. And don't forget, new listeners, we are on iTunes. It's free. Doesn't cost you anything. You can sign up there, and it makes your life a lot easier because whenever a new show goes up, it automatically downloads for you. You don't even have to think about it. So find the Solomonster Sounds Off, I think, is what it is listed under on iTunes. One last quick note here. I didn't realize it until this past week, but in fact, next weekend, which will be episode 133 of the Sound Off, marks the 3-year anniversary of this podcast. Next weekend, it'll be 3 years ago, in November of 2007, that episode 1 first appeared on SEScoops.com, and it's been a nice marriage ever since then. It's been a lot of fun doing this show, and hopefully many, many more episodes. But next weekend, we'll celebrate 3 years. I don't have anything special planned, to be honest with you, at this point. Maybe I'll think of something during the week, play some old clips or something like I did for episode 100. But, yeah, so if you've been listening for the entire run of this podcast, or most of it, or some of it, or if you're a new listener, send in your feedback. Let me know how long you've been listening for. Maybe we'll share some stories next week. So big thank you to everybody who's made this podcast possible, because without you listening, I wouldn't be doing it. It's been a fun 3 years. Here's to three more, and we'll see you next week for the big sound-off, episode 133. So until next time, have fun this weekend if you're going out for Halloween. Stay safe. Be well. Be back here next week, right here on sescoops.com. Thanks a lot, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on sescoops.com.